So, I'm here in Chester at the Adoption Matters conference. I spent a rather interesting evening in a travel lodge with some young women at 1 o'clock this morning who were having a full and frank exchange outside my bedroom window about some boy or other. It ended in tears, which was unfortunate for everyone concerned, including me. Just getting ready. We're off to this conference. I'm speaking this afternoon, doing a workshop about challenging childhood violent and aggressive behaviour with Hetty Verhagen, and we're going to talk about the... I guess we're going to try and ask some questions about what good support looks like, what that means for adoptive families. The focus is adoption. And hopefully there's lots of other people who are going to be here today. There's John Simmons, John Timpson, Sadie King, Marie Kershaw. There's a whole host of people. So I'm looking forward to listening to them. And if I can, I'm going to try and grab them for a little interviews and to see what they're thinking and what they're talking about. And hopefully report back. I've had my breakfast in a box, and that was probably the most exciting thing that's happened to me in a long time. So, okay, I shall report back. So I've arrived here now, and it's quite busy. Lots of faces that I know and recognise, and lots of faces I know and don't recognise. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try and collar some of the speakers. I've not arranged anything, not planned anything, not even asked Adoption Matters, so that might go all rather badly wrong. But I think we can call this guerrilla podcasting. So Hetty, we're at the Adoption Support Conference for Adoption Matters, and who are you?
I'm Hetty. My actual name's Hedwig Verhagen. I always write that one down, but Everybody knows me as Hetty.
Yeah.
And I'm the praxis manager, one of the praxis managers at the Centre for Adoption Support, and I also do therapeutic work there.
So this afternoon you and I, we're doing a joint session on challenging violent and aggressive behaviour. So how come you've been picked to do that? Tell me what your experience and thoughts on that.
My very first case as a qualified social worker was to do with child parent violence. I just graduated. I went straight into adoption support, which is quite unusual for a social worker. And I think it was at the end of my second week, on a Friday afternoon, we had a call of parents who said, "You've got to come and get our son now. He's been violent again. We can't have him in the house anymore." And there was nobody in Friday afternoon. And I said, I'll go out. So that was my very first call out as a social worker. And if I look back to that, I said all the wrong things. I was really not helpful. But they did decide that he could stay the weekend, and then he's still there, he's in his 20s
right.
now.
You got through it, you managed.
I didn't mess it up too badly. But driving back from that visit, that feeling of nothing I've learned was helpful.
Yeah.
And I need to know this better. I need to know what to do, because I just thought, if this is what this job is, 2 weeks into the job, I need to be able to do this.
But at that time, thinking 10 years ago, that probably within an adoption service that was known, but actually, and I guess you're not a local authority, you work in a different environment, don't you?
Yes, I was in the local authority for 5 years,
right.
And then I was part of the setting up of the Centre for Adoption Support.
So what do you turn the clock forward to now then? What service does adoption, I mean, I'm not here to plug the service, but if you're going to plug it, let's just go for it, let's just do it. What service do you offer now? What's different now? If you got that phone call today, what would be different?
Oh, that's a challenging question, because if we got that phone call today, I'm not in the local authority anymore. We're in a service that does planned work with families. So I wouldn't just be able to jump in the car and go and do whatever's necessary.
If a family came to you, you know, and a part of this, because you do have families that are part of the service and come through you.
Yeah.
If they said, actually, this is an issue for us.
Yeah.
What's the different response that you have now?
We'd invite somebody to, we talk to them on the phone, obviously, and we'd invite them to come for a consultation with one of our workers to kind of unpick what's going on in the family. And that may lead to a suggestion to approach the REA or the local authority for funding for therapeutic work. It may be that they come to our workshop we do run a workshop on child to parent violence and aggression, but actually a lot of the time it's not that. It's,
right.
You know, come to therapeutic parenting, come to a day on DDP, come to a day on shame. You know, it could be all sorts. Are you quite sure? Your face suggests that you're shocked by a day on shame.
I'm not shocked at all. I'm really happy. I love
a day on shame.
A day of shame. No, that's interesting because that's something that I've increasingly been doing when people ask me for help. I think that's a key. It's a key component of what is going on, and the fact that you're offering, you're saying to people, there is not one solution.
Oh, absolutely not. No, and I see. I'm very interested in trauma and how trauma impacts not just your thoughts but your body and your whole organism. So it's far more complex than we can even understand. And the violent and aggressive behaviour is not a thing on its own. It's part of that whole complex response to what has happened. So we can't just put it in a little box and say, now we deal with the violence and aggression.
Yeah.
Because you have to deal with the whole child and with the child's system and with the child's past.
That's really interesting. Not, I think because that's one thing that I increasingly see is that that's where the delicate work is done around that system. What does your family life look like?
And how does your family fit in their wider system? Mm. How, you know, I was just talking to one of the other speakers here at the conference about how they adopted in the 80s. And he just said, we were really lucky that our family stuck with us because I don't know whether we would have been able to do it if they hadn't. And our experience with the families we work with is that often that is not something that's there for them.
Mm-hmm.
That system has kind of crumbled for all sorts of complex reasons.
Yeah, and also thinking about, I mean, it's a delicate issue because I think often you're working with families that are in crisis, but the reality is that they're not to blame, but maybe they could do things differently.
And that is such a delicate thing to say. It's whenever, so when I say, or we say to people, come to training, that is a really hard thing to have that discussion, because what it sounds like to a person in crisis is, what you're telling me that there's something I don't know, and there's something, you're telling me this is me.
It's the way I do it, the way I parent is the issue.
Yeah, and it is exactly what you say. It's having that kind of really reflective conversation about, this is not your fault, but there are some things that you could do that maybe make a difference.
And I recently worked with a group of families, all kinds of families, who weren't necessarily adoptive. There were some adopters there. And to get to that conversation took me 7.5 hours with that group of people, because I thought
you did well in 7.5 hours.
I took a chance, but I think that I was just so conscious of the sense of people really bruised, so I'm encouraged that we've come to the same conclusion independently. It must be true then. It must be true. So you're speaking this afternoon. What are you speaking on?
We're talking about, I think we said we talk about different perspectives, but I'm not quite sure whether that's what we're doing now. Well, there's you and there's me, and we're both human beings, so we've got different perspectives. But I think we probably agree on quite a lot of things. I think what's really important for me is to take child to parent violence out of this specialism box. I see, and this actually happened in our service, that it was me. I've always been the violence. You know, if you get a teenager who's been violent or aggressive, Hetty will work with them. You kind of get your cases because of where your interest lies. But then you get these specialisms.
Yeah.
So you'd get a phone call from somebody, like the phone call that, you know, if we get that phone call from 10 years ago now. And then the response might be, oh, you need to speak to Hetty, or you need to speak to Nigel, another one of my colleagues who's very interested in this. But actually, it should be everybody.
Mm.
An adoptive parent, a parent, should be able to pick up the phone and speak to somebody who works in children's services or support services, and they will just, that they can presume that they will be able to respond in a helpful way to this.
Yeah.
Not for somebody to go, oh, this is a violent or aggressive child. I don't know about this.
Yeah. And I think that is a really clear message that we're coming to, isn't it? I think we've talked about this a lot, and other people I've talked to is that actually it needs to be common parlance.
Yeah, this is part of so many people's lives that we have to just think this is another one of those parenting tasks mm-hmm. that we need to help people with. It's not something that just happens to some people in very specific situations. This is, you know, pretty much across the board. And if we treat it as a specialism, you're never going to address the stigma.
Well, that is fantastic. I'm conscious that they're serving dinner.
We're not missing food, are we?
We're missing food, so thank you very much for the tea, and I look forward to our core presentation later on.
It'll be fantastic.
It will. I might record it. Is that okay?
Yeah.
That's cool. So, John, you have... you were speaking this morning about the policy context of adoption. So what?
Yeah.
What was your message, or your takeaways?
I suppose it falls within something that's become very important to me recently is the issue about how fundamental it is to who we are as a human species, our survival, our adaptation, our ability to be able to solve problems. To kind of work in a spirit of cooperative venture, and I think one of the things that feels particularly important when it comes to adoption is that there's so much within adoption which kind of raises issues about conflict, disagreement, disapproval, unfairness, injustice. And the system has to deal with those issues. I mean, wherever that comes to and however that affects somebody individually. But the system as a whole, and particularly, I think, what drives the professional part of the system is a sense of listening to people, trying to understand where they're coming from, what they're struggling with, what potential solutions might be, where they might be going to in the future. But the overarching part of that is that it's a conversation that needs to be had within that spirit of cooperative venture.
I mean, that's quite a lofty.
Yeah.
It's almost a philosophical.
It is.
And how do you see that worked out in the current system? Do you see it worked out in the current system?
Sometimes. I mean, I think that regional adoption agencies, at their best, were designed in a spirit of cooperative venture, bringing professionals together to identify the best of what they do and deliver the best of what they do in all the kind of various stages of the process that adoption actually involves. But I think the thing that worries me about, while I think that's a driver, I don't think that we've paid enough attention to the uncertainties, anxieties, conflicts, and the risks involved both directly in the adoption process itself. They have to be put into words in some kind of way or another. But I think it's equally an issue with regional adoption agencies that we're creating different workforces, different sets of relationships, different ways of doing things, different histories, different kind of locations, geographical mm-hmm. locations. And unless any of that and the feelings that it stirs up as that's disrupted in some kind of way is thoughtfully and appropriately worked out and put into words, people can end up falling into silos where they just get on with what they do. They feel unsupported, unheard in the struggle to do adoption well.
Are you optimistic for the future? You seem quite pessimistic. Are you seeing good practice?
Yes. No, definitely. I definitely hear a series of messages from people where they feel that they've worked really hard to be driven by that spirit of cooperative venture. I mean, it's not how they would put it. And there's some evidence that's actually the case. And, I think it is the best of the profession and it is the best of the sector. But there's still too much that is not being spoken about. And I think one of them is this significant drop-off in the number of children that are leaving care through an adoption order, or indeed through any permits order, that includes special guardianship and child arrangement orders as well. We don't have an explanation as to why that is. I don't feel comfortable with that at all. Is it RAAs that are playing their part in that as they become divorced, or there's a kind of lack of direct engagement with the child care planning team still in the local authorities? Are there issues about local judges and predicting their kind of where the, on what side of the orders that they're likely to fall? I mean, we just don't know the answer to that. But I think we need, in a spirit of cooperative venture, to be really exploring and thinking about those issues. Because at the heart of this, there's a group of very vulnerable children, you know, who for the rest of their lives will be dependent on the decisions and the work that we do now to settle them into some kind of an ordinary family life, which brings the best of what we have as adults to offer them.
That's a great answer, and I think reflecting on what you're saying is that in some ways that needs to be on an individual work, social work level.
Absolutely.
Right through teams and corporate and then right to the very head.
Yes, relationships are absolutely core to that, and relationships driven by a spirit of cooperative venture is how I've kind of been thinking about that in, you know, challenging times at the moment.
Well, thank you. As always, it's great to speak to you and listen to you, so I'll let you get on to your next venture.
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're Sir Mark Headley, and you are an adoptive parent.
Yep.
And you're an ex, or are you a current High Court
No,
judge?
I was a former High Court judge, but I still act occasionally as a High Court judge.
Right. And you were speaking this morning at the Adoption Matters Conference, and you were talking about the legal context of the UK adoption. So I was wondering, on a really basic level, one of the most interesting things you said was you compared the UK's legal a kind of system for adoption against the world, if you could kind of unpick that.
Yes, well, the adoption is a relatively newcomer to English law. I mean, 1926 was the first time we had it. And we've developed a form of adoption law which is unusual in the world, partly because of the way the legal extinguishing of natural parents, and partly because we have power to impose adoptions on unwilling parents through the dispensing with consent provisions. If one looks across the world at anything that's been influenced by Roman Catholic, Islamic or Jewish culture, the concept of the extinguishment of the natural family is a very difficult one. In countries which are significantly influenced by rights legislations, the concept of an imposed adoption is a very difficult one. Mm-hmm. And so our having both marks us out in the world as quite a minority view about adoption. It's not to say our view is not a good one, but it is a minority view.
Yeah, and there was a phrase you used when you were speaking. You said about this, the English view being of adoption being narrow and a hardline view in the context of the world's legislation, thinking about the Human Rights Act.
Yes. You see, our adoption law is perfectly consistent with the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child and the European Convention, because both of them recognise that in decision-making you may put the interests of a child first. So they are conceptually compliant.
Yeah.
But of course, both conventions acknowledge a huge breadth of practice. And I think I'm simply saying we're at the harder line end, as far as adoption is concerned, of practice, because of those two particular characteristics.
And there's been some controversy over the last few years where there's been judges' rulings have been, or statements have been interpreted certain ways by professionals, and you were talking about what Judge Mumby had said.
Yeah, I think what happened was that we had the 2002 law. I don't believe it's changed since the law was passed, but undoubtedly a very large number of people thought it had been changed by the Court of Appeal in, I think it was 2013, and a decision of Sir James Mumby, who was the then president. He has always insisted, and on reading his judgment, I'm sure he's right, that they are not changing the law at all. What they are doing is saying, this is such a serious matter, it's got to be justified. You really have got to be able to explain that not only is adoption the best thing for this child, but it's the only thing that's truly consistent with the welfare of this child. And, you know, all too often, neither social workers nor judges were actually going through that exercise properly. And that's what he was complaining about.
That's obviously been interpreted a different way.
It has. And lots of local authorities, and I think probably this organisation too, slightly took fright. Well, this organisation would, because there would be fewer adoptions coming through from local authorities. But there was a general taking fright. I don't quite know where that's at the moment. I haven't seen the most recent figures. But I'm quite sure that what the courts were saying was not that there should be less adoptions, but there should be better thought through and better justified adoptions, particularly where coercive powers are being used.
Which is the majority?
I don't know these days, is it? You may well be right. I haven't actually seen the statistics. Obviously, the consensual adoption is not only unacceptable here, but in much of Europe, the consensual adoptions are a perfectly understood concept. Mm-hmm. It's the coercive one that marks us out in Europe.
Yeah, and I think what I found very interesting was that in some ways there's two systems running in parallel. There's a legal system and a social care system.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how the UK judges are listening to an international voice on adoption, that perhaps social care isn't listening to that voice. And do you think that that's going to influence the future legislative changes?
Well, I think, of course, neither social workers nor judges have control of the legislative process at the end of the day. So what happens there, of course, it's out of our hands. As I understand the current generation of judicial thinking, which is, it has to be said, the one after me, I think that they are not disposed to restrict adoption, but they are disposed to say we need to be satisfied that this is the only proper solution for this child. I think that's roughly where the Supreme Court are at. Although they keep talking about care orders and adoption orders as last resorts, it's always qualified by their saying, nevertheless, welfare is paramount. Yeah. And if welfare justifies it. Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you, isn't it? Very precious.
Thank you.
They cost nothing.
Thank you.
And as welfare is paramount, of course, you in the right case, you'll be able to justify it.
Yeah, but I think that's interesting. Do you think that there will be, and maybe asking you an impossible question, crystal ball, thinking with the whole weight of the nations, that's probably a bad phrase to use, but the whole voice of international adoption sort of at the other end of the spectrum, do you think that the UK is eventually going to move to a position where there's less adoption orders made?
I genuinely don't know the answer to that. I think it'll only move there if there is a very strong general public feeling that it should.
Right.
I don't think the judiciary are going to take it in that direction. I mean, the reality is that the care system has never been busier than it is now.
Yeah.
And there is no reason to think, looking across society at large, that our family structures are any more stable or getting any more stable than they are at the moment.
Yeah.
So on the face of it, that's all going to continue. And there is no doubt that adoption is, from a stability and attachment point of view, very often the best solution,
yeah,
especially with young children. And so I see no reason why that should diminish, unless there is a public movement such that parliamentarians are going to react to it.
Because I've noticed a change in language. I mean, as I said earlier, I've been an adoptive parent now for 20 years this year. I've seen a use of language around forced adoption.
Yes.
As opposed to adoption without consent, which is a nuance, but it's an emotive nuance,
isn't it? It is. No, I quite agree. But I think that's partly a characteristic of the whole of our public life is to use more emotive language in terms of opposing things that we don't like, or even sporting things, actually, than perhaps we used to. So I suspect adoption is merely a casualty of that trend, rather than there being a particular focus on adoption.
And what about the rise of special guardianship orders? Because that's been...
Well, the rise of special guardianship orders, I think, is probably more interrelated to the making of care orders rather than adoption orders. There is no doubt that local authorities have discovered that if you can do kinship care placements, then special guardianship orders are cheaper, easier, and more convenient for the local authority than care orders. There's no doubt about that, and there's no doubt that they exploit that. I think by the time you're talking about adoption orders, in order to justify an adoption order, you've got to show that there isn't a potential special guardian who could provide that which is consistent with the welfare of the child. Mm. So I think probably if you were comparing impact on orders, you probably ought to compare it with the impact on care orders rather than adoption orders.
Right. That makes sense.
Particularly in neglect cases.
Yeah, and I do think that it is interesting to see the rise in special guardianship orders, which is almost on a par with adoption orders now. I think it's within a few hundred.
Yes, and actually I shall not be at all surprised to see special guardianship orders rise, because initially they were intended for particularly grandparents or long-term foster parents whose children didn't want to be part of the care system. But I think once we get to the stage where same generation as parents, uncles and aunts and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. or even sibs are prepared to be special guardians, I think we may well see a rise in special guardianship. Because the position of a special guardian is much stronger than the position of someone who just holds a residence order.
Yeah, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, and that's a good, yes, quite. And it means they've got exclusive, in practice, they've got exclusive parental responsibility. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they have a residence order, they merely share it on equal terms with the parents.
I can ask you a personal question?
Do.
You don't have to answer. I'm sure you're good at dodging questions, being a High Court judge, if you don't want to answer them. So adoption for you, how's that been?
I wouldn't have missed it. Let's put it that way. It's hardly been plain sailing.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't, if I could go back, I wouldn't change it. And I've found the most interesting thing, actually, in more recent years, is talking to my two natural children about their perceptions and being really very pleasantly surprised by how positive they've been
right.
about having two adopted children in the family who came and messed their lives up and, you know, diverted attention from them.
And ask you why you adopted them. Is that too cheeky?
No. I think part of it would be very difficult to divorce the answer to that from Christian faith, which I've always professed, so it would be an expression of that. But I think it was partly my wife was a health visitor. We both come from big families, and we had a big house in the middle of Liverpool. And I think she tells me I'm guilty for all the drive that lay behind it.
Right.
But it's undoubtedly the case that she's carried the heat and burden of the day, which I suppose is ever a story, isn't it? But I think it was just, yes, part and parcel of how do we make the best use of our family. I mean, we would always define a Christian family as a family where there's always space for one more. And I think that was, you know, a little bit behind it.
Yeah.
And we've had all sorts of interesting people living with us over the years who've not necessarily been children. So I think that was it. I don't think it was any sort of great thing. It was just part of our thinking about how we live family life, really.
And one final question.
Yeah.
Thinking about the 2002 Adoption and Children Act, the provision in there is the requirement or the statutory duty for an assessment of the needs of the adopted yeah. children and family. What was your experience of adoption support through the years? And also, what, in some ways, is it a nonsensical piece of legislation because there's no duty to then provide it?
Well, our experience, it was particularly acute with the disabled one, was that for as long as he was in care, we were at the front of every queue. The moment he wasn't in care, we were competent parents with a disabled child and we took our place. And that was very obvious with a disabled child. Now, in fact, I don't ever remember as not being given support when we asked for it, but I don't ever remember as being offered it when we hadn't asked. If you see what I mean.
It's a nuance.
Yes. And in a sense, I suppose it's... We got some very good support from Liverpool when our older adoption one was about 9 or 10, because mercifully the same social worker was still on the same team and came back and did some really good post-adoption work with him. And that was very valuable. Likewise, the Liverpool post-adoption service did very good work with him when he was in his 20s and wanting to explore meeting up with a natural family. So we had good support at those two points where they were needed. And at other points, as I say, I think only if we went and banged on someone's door and said, you know, please.
I'm guessing as a barrister or a High Court judge, maybe people listen to you banging on doors in...
Well, I'm sure that's right. And there was a wonderful minute I saw in an education thing where we'd been carrying on about him going into mainstream school, which simply said, the professional view is this child should be in special school. The parents won't rest until we've tried mainstream school, so we'll put him in mainstream school but keep him on the roll of the special school, which was a compromise we were delighted with, of course, because it meant there was a fail-safe if we were wrong. So we were listened to. Without, you know, it wasn't because we went around breaking people's windows. We were listened to in, you know, ordinary discussion. And that gave us an advantage. But my guess is that many adoptive parents are able to make sure they're listened to. There'll be some who aren't. I fully acknowledge that. I don't have any real experience of what you might call consistent post-adoption support. Mm-hmm. There was support there when it was needed and asked for.
That's fantastic. And so the provision in the 2002 to assess you but not provide.
Well, of course, we adopted before that Act came in, so I'm not terribly familiar with that. And it's interesting you mention it, because in actually considering adoption orders, we do normally, the adoption reports now do say something about that. As to the special guardianship reports, because they have to. But as you say, they are actually unenforceable at the end of the day.
Complicated message for families then, isn't it?
Well, it is, you're dependent on the fact that a local authority values its good name enough not to be found to be in breach of its duty. But of course, in straitened days where there's limited, the money goes on A, the most needy, and B, the loudest, probably.
Well, that has been fantastic, and I'm aware that this is your day off. So
well, it's not quite a day. It is a working day. I don't mind.
So thank you very much for your time. And
pleasure.
We'll get this out on the podcast and let people listen, and we'll see what comments come back to you.
Thank you very much.
So, over to you guys. Look forward to what you have to say.
Thank you.
And we'll pick up a bit later.
Yeah, that's cool. We're sharing the presentation, so it may be a bit over to me. My name is Al Coates, and I'm a social worker, which every time I say that, I feel like I'm in a recovery group. The first step to getting better is just admitting you're a social worker. Primarily, I see myself as a dad. That's my first point of call. I adopted 3 children in 1999 with my wife. I then went on to be a foster carer in 2006 with my wife as well. And we fostered 2 little girls who we then subsequently adopted. So there you go, that was a fantastic day, and I'm really glad I came. Lots of food for thought. I was really disappointed I didn't get time to spend with Marie Kershaw or Adoption Blog Fox. Would have been wonderful to catch up with them, maybe interview them. Didn't get a chance to do that, so now I'm going to go home. It's going to take me about 4 hours, and once I'm home, I can have a little nap. Actually, I might even steal a little nap on the train. Okay, look after yourselves. Bye.